KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Benedict was seen as a conservative pope. His successor, Francis, was more open. What kind of leader might Catholic cardinals choose next? We assess the upcoming conclave on Morning Edition from NPR News. A Maryland parent wants her kid to opt out of lessons in school if they conflict with her faith. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. That led to a Supreme Court case. Do parents have the right to pick and choose in public education? Also, many borrowers must resume paying student loans. And how should a judge undo Google's monopoly on digital ads? It's Tuesday, April 22nd. This day in 1954, Senator Joseph McCarthy began televised hearings in his hunt for communists. The man most damaged by those hearings was McCarthy. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Vatican says Pope Francis's funeral will be this Saturday. In his final Easter address, the pontiff called the situation in Gaza dramatic and deplorable after a year and a half of war. NPR's Anas Baba reports the Pope was a constant source of comfort to Gaza's Christians.
Up until his last moments, Pope Francis reached out and spoke up for Palestinians in Gaza. George Anton is a leader at the Holy Family Church, Gaza's only Catholic church. He said that the Pope called the congregation every evening, blessing them over speakerphone, asking if they had enough food or if they were safe in the church where they are sheltering from Israeli bombing. Anton said the last call was made the day before he died. How are you? Anton said the Pope asked, I'm praying for you. Pray for me. I need your prayers. Anton said, we feel orphaned now. The Pope was a shield for Christians in Gaza. Today, he said less than 600 Christians remain in Gaza. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
NPR has learned that the White House may be looking for a new defense secretary. That's after Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth used the messaging app Signal to share sensitive information about U.S. military strikes on Yemen, this time with his family. This is the second time Hegseth used the Signal chat to do this, and it was on a personal cell phone. Hegseth denies that any of the shared information was classified.
What was shared over Signal, then and now, however you characterize it, was informal, unclassified coordinations for media coordination and other things. That's what I've said from the beginning. At the beginning, it was left-wing reporters from The Atlantic who got a hold of it and then wanted to create a problem for the president. This is what it's all about, trying to get at President Trump and his agenda.
He spoke to Fox News. A note, NPR's CEO Catherine Marr is the chair of the board of the Signal Foundation, which supports the messaging app. Stocks opened higher this morning, regaining some of the ground lost in yesterday's sell-off. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped nearly 600 points in early trading.
The partial rebound in the stock market comes amid new warnings of economic fallout from President Trump's trade war. The International Monetary Fund predicts the combination of Trump's tariffs and economic uncertainty will cut into global growth this year. The IMF has downgraded its growth forecast for the United States by nearly a full percentage point. Economists say the trade war will lead to lower productivity and higher prices in the U.S. Trump wants the Federal Reserve to cushion the slowdown by lowering interest rates, but so far the central bank's been cautious for fear of rekindling inflation. Trump's attacks on Fed Chairman Jerome Powell have rattled financial markets, contributing to Monday's sharp drop in the stock market. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Harvard University is suing the Trump administration. This is to stop the White House from trying to freeze billions of dollars in federal funding. Harvard claims the administration is trying to control academic decision-making. Officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement refused an urgent request from a former Columbia University graduate student to be with his wife in labor. ICE denied the request by Mahmoud Khalil. His wife delivered their son yesterday in New York. The Trump administration is trying to deport Khalil. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass is proposing to lay off more than 1,600 city employees. From LAist News, Frank Stoltz reports the mayor is trying to deal with a shortfall of nearly $1 billion.
The layoffs would likely cut across a wide swath of city departments, from recreation and parks to street services. They're necessitated in part because of last year's big pay raises for city employees, which will add about $250 million in costs to next year's budget. As costs have increased, revenues are headed down because of the weakening economy. City officials are predicting President Trump's trade tariffs are likely to make things even worse. The Los Angeles City Council must approve a budget by June 1st. For NPR News, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
The Department of Homeland Security says a thief stole the purse of Secretary Kristi Noem on Sunday night. She was at a Washington, D.C. restaurant having dinner with her family. She's lost her passport, agency badge, and about $3,000 in cash. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's now up 1.5%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The death of Pope Francis is a story out of Rome. But when the leader of a church with 1.4 billion members dies, that story is personal for so many in this world.
And we've been hearing from Americans who felt a connection to the Pope. Bishop Carl Kemmy of Wichita, Kansas, remembers meeting him.
His warmth, his ingratiating smile, his humility, his simple way of living.
Okay, it's to be expected that a bishop would appreciate the Pope, but his fans also included Tom Scazzafava, who is an electrician in Port Henry, New York.
If they want to get people active again in the church, especially the younger people, this Pope, you know, opened the door in regards to that.
One of those younger people is Natalie Borrega of Austin, Texas, who is 28.
He really had a heart for the poorest of the poor, and I think he really inspired and strengthened my dedication to the Catholic faith.
Those are some American views of Pope Francis. Now let's hear some views from the place where his funeral will be held.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock is in Rome. Hi there, Ruth.
Hi, good morning.
What are you hearing from people in St. Peter's Square?
There's real emotion and a sense of loss. You know, many were in tears at the rosary prayers last night. But Steve, people are also talking about Francis's legacy, about what he stood for in his 12 years as Pope. This is Ruth Angeletti from Montana.
His concern for others and the world, the environment, but concern for other people and trying to set an example.
Part of that example was to his own church. Francis famously derided the wealth and the lace and the frills that come with the papacy. He'd wear simpler outfits, he kept his plastic watch, travelled in a small Fiat car, promoting this idea of a less ornate, gold-laden church. And then he was also an advocate for migrants and the environment and seen as being friendlier to the LGBTQ faithful. He's been accused, though, of not making substantial enough changes to the church. Here's Ian Kilroy from Ireland.
I think Francis was too radical for the conservatives in the church and not radical enough for the reformers in the church. But certainly his impulse was towards reform within Catholicism, and he will be remembered for that.
So even among regular people, you can kind of see the debates taking shape on what his future legacy might be.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to reflect on how much he changed the tone of the church without changing the underlying rules of the church.
Yeah, exactly.
And now we go on to the funeral and a selection. What are you hearing about the next few days?
His body will be moved to St. Peter's Basilica, where people could come to see him from Wednesday. Previous popes were placed in these three nested coffins standing on an elevated bier for the public viewing. But Francis has ordered that he'll be put in a single wooden coffin, and it's going to be positioned facing the church pews. His funeral will be Saturday. Of course, many people will come from all around the world, including President Trump.
And then what about the conclave that comes after?
Well, it's the largest conclave in history. Pope Francis has appointed 108 of the 135 cardinals who can vote in that conclave. Here's Austin Ivory, Pope Francis's biographer.
He's appointed so many cardinals who are from far-flung places, often with very small Catholic populations, who are on the frontier of interreligious dialogue or war or suffering, or anyway, the realities of the world, so that they bring those realities into the room.
So even if Francis chooses cardinals with a similar outlook, experts say many will still differ in view on some of the huge range of issues, and there's really no guarantee that the conclave will choose a more liberal pope like Francis.
Yeah, it's a fascinating choice to be watching. NPR's Ruth Sherlock, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on that choice, the selection of the next pope, we're joined by Massimo Foggioli. He's a church historian and professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
So we just heard there from our correspondent that this is the largest enclave we've seen. Cardinals that Pope Francis appointed come from every corner of the world with very different experiences and perspectives. How will that diversity shape the kind of leader they might choose?
We don't know. That's the mystery of the conclave always, but this time particularly, because being appointed cardinal by Francis means something for a cardinal from Asia. Mm-hmm. It means something else from Africa. It means something else for Chicago or Washington, D.C. or Newark. So it's really a much more complicated chemistry this time, because also there's a very complicated international situation which affects different cardinals, different local churches in different ways. And so this time it's even more difficult than usual to make predictions, even on the agenda of the conclave, meaning what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the complicated political situation worldwide. I mean, right now, that's being shaped by wars, civil instability, and polarization, and that includes the U.S. What role might that play in choosing a new pope?
Well, in the last century, it was clear that the Vatican and the United States were working like two parallel empires, one with hard and soft power, and the Vatican only soft power. Mm-hmm. Of course. So there was this alliance which went through difficult times, sometimes the Iraq War and so on, but it was pretty stable. Right now, it's much harder to understand what if this alliance is still there and what kind of relationship there is because of what's happening between the U.S. government and the Catholic Church domestically, but also internationally. And so this might be a factor because the conclave has its own geopolitical thinking. Let's think about John Paul II elected from Poland in 1978 during the Cold War. And so we don't know what it means now, but surely it's a factor that we did not have in conclaves of the previous 100 years.
Say more about that. I mean, is this going to be a pope then that engages politically differently?
All popes engage politically. This time, it might be a pope who is called to speak truth, not just to Russia or the Soviet Union as it was during John Paul II, but meaning speaking truth also to American power, which means now something different from the truth that John Paul II or Pope Benedict spoke to George W. Bush or to Ronald Reagan. Also because U.S. Catholicism is one of the biggest, most influential, richest church in the world. And so there are many different factors that the election of the Pope has to take into account. Once America was a known known, now it's a known unknown.
Okay.
Because of what the administration might do with Russia, with China, with Israel. There are so many unknowns now.
Well, let's talk about Pope Francis's image. I mean, he was seen as a more liberal pope, from issues on inclusion of LGBTQ Catholics to migrant populations. Could the next pope move to distance the church from those positions or continue that?
It's possible. Historically, we see in different conclaves a certain swinging of the pendulum. What the conclave and the next pope cannot do is to ignore and deny the changing features of global Catholicism, which is much less European, much less white, less North American, and more global South, meaning not necessarily liberal, but surely much more critical of capitalism as it is today, on certain cultural issues that we call liberal, but in the global South are more traditional.
I'm just wondering, in the few seconds we have left, what you're watching most closely in this conclave.
I'm watching for those voices that we haven't heard, from cardinals from the margins that we haven't heard and might have an opportunity in those meetings in the Vatican to become more known, because this is a much larger college, but also of figures that are less known.
Massimo Fagioli, church historian and professor at Villanova University. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
For the first time since the pandemic began, the government will collect on debts from student loan borrowers in default. NPR's Janaki Mehta reports.
For more than 5 years now, there have been no federal student loans referred for collection. That reprieve was extended multiple times under the Biden administration, but it was never intended to be permanent, and now it's coming to an end. In an announcement Monday evening, the Department of Education said the government would restart the collection of involuntary payments on May 5th. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said in a statement, quote, American taxpayers will no longer be forced to serve as collateral for irresponsible student loan policies. Going into default means borrowers haven't made their loan payments for 9 months. That gets reported on their credit scores. And according to the Education Department, about 5.3 million borrowers have loans in default. And it says that number could reach nearly 10 million in a matter of months.
Wow, this could not have come at a worse time.
That's Aisa Canchola-Banez, policy director for the nonprofit Student Loan Borrower Center. She says the country is already facing economic uncertainty, and this new policy piles on.
Families are really having to navigate rising costs across the board for everyday goods, you know, food, rent, childcare, and a lot of those folks have student loans.
When borrowers in default take a hit to their credit scores, they can have a harder time qualifying for other loans that can help them pay for housing, cars, and other basic necessities. Those kinds of consequences are about to affect millions more borrowers whose debt will now be sent to collections. The department also said that later this summer, it will begin sending notices to people still in default, beginning the process of wage garnishment. That means money would be taken directly out of their paychecks and sent to the federal government to pay off their debts. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Government professor Stephen Levitsky has spent years studying how democracies die. On the next Fresh Air, he argues the Trump administration is pushing the U.S. towards a 21st century form of autocracy, where elections, opposition parties, and independent media still exist, but are weakened by the incumbent government's abuses of power. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at viking.com. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend. At easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Today, the Supreme Court considers a question about public schools. That question, whether and when parents should be allowed to pull their kids out of class over religious objections. Can parents pick and choose different bits of the curriculum, taking education a la carte? NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
On one side are parents who want to opt their elementary school children out of classes that include books with LGBTQ characters because the materials violate their faith. And on the other side is the school board, as well as other parents and kids, who want the curriculum to include lessons teaching tolerance and respect for LGBTQ students and parents. At the center of today's case is the school system in Montgomery County, Maryland, the most religiously diverse county in the U.S., with 160,000 students of almost all faiths. At issue is whether parents are entitled to opt their children out of classes when they object to the school district's curriculum on religious grounds. Grace Morrison is one of the parents suing the school board. Her daughter, who has Down syndrome, was in a special needs general curriculum class when the school board decided to include books that talk about LGBTQ children and parents. Her daughter was by then 10, and Morrison was concerned that her daughter would be confused by the books.
They are in conflict with our faith, and I also think it's too heavy for our daughter. These are topics that I'm just not ready to start on down the road with her.
While the school board initially allowed parents to opt their children out of regular classes with some LGBTQ content, the board eventually found that the opt-outs were both too difficult and too disruptive. In the Supreme Court today, the board's lawyer will tell the justices that it's relatively easy to have opt-outs for a single class like health and sex ed, and Montgomery County does that. But it is a logistical nightmare to take children out of a classroom when a single storybook that features same-sex parents or gay and lesbian kids could come up at any time. Parents of multiple faiths and even kids mobilized to have their views heard by the school board, with as many as 1,000 people gathering for one school board meeting, including a boy who identified himself as Nick and liked having storybooks that included LGBTQ characters.
We have rights too. We deserve to have books in our school that teach people about LGBTQ and stuff. It's not touching you, hurting you physically. I don't know why you hate it so much.
In the Supreme Court today, parents objecting to the books make two important points. First, that the Supreme Court has long ruled parents are in charge of guiding their children's values. And second, that to force these books on their children is a violation of the Constitution's guarantee to the free exercise of religion. As Grace Morrison, the mother of the special needs youngster, put it,
I find that it's just very heartbreaking to me how many parents feel like they have to choose between educating their child and raising their children in their faith.
Representing the objecting parents in the Supreme Court today is Eric Baxter of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He'll tell the justices that schools have, for decades, allowed opt-outs for religious reasons.
Most people believe that their children should have a period of time when they don't have to deal with these kind of heavier topics. It goes to their children's very identity, how they will form families, have children. the things that most people think are some of the most important decisions you'll make in your life.
So how should school districts draw the line? Should parents be able to opt their kids out of a science class about Darwin's theory of evolution or a history class that includes a section about women in the workplace? Some religions object to both of those things. Again, Lawyer Baxter.
So what if one kid wants to opt out of dissecting frogs during biology? A lot of states actually have laws that allow those kinds of opt-outs.
Yale Law Professor Justin Driver, who's written extensively about the history of public schools, says that these decisions about the public school curriculum have traditionally been left to local school boards. And it is indeed one of the reasons that school board elections can get rather heated. But for the most part, he says, the courts have deferred to school boards unless there's evidence that students are being coerced into accepting an underlying religious belief. This case, he contends, has no evidence of coercion. Rather, some parents object to having their children even exposed to certain ideas.
It seems to me that the process is working as it should, rather than empowering individual parents or students to be able to control it. People have raised objections. The school district has heard those objections and modified their practice.
This is not a case of children being coerced into religious beliefs, he contends. It's a case of some parents wanting to avoid having their children even exposed to a wide variety of ideas in class, including a book, for instance, in which a child attends the wedding of his uncle to another man. Again, Professor Driver.
Public school is meant to be for a broad group, and some individuals are going to express misgivings about the curriculum decisions, but it's not been the court's tradition to permit those individuals to carry the day. In a big, religiously diverse country like the United States, local public schools have not been required to afford these opt-outs because of the workability concerns for the public schools.
Indeed, because school boards do reflect the views of their constituents, there are places like San Francisco where some books with LGBTQ themes are required in the curriculum. Professor Driver.
It's important to appreciate who is the right entity for making curricular decisions. Is it the public school or is it federal judges?
The odds of the Supreme Court not intervening in this case to require some sort of opt-outs could be slim. The current court, dominated by very conservative justices, including three Trump appointees, has increasingly focused not on the Constitution's guarantee of separation between church and state, but on the First Amendment guarantee to the free exercise of religion. What's more, only three of the nine justices were educated in public schools. Justices Samuel Alito, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Elena Kagan. The other six justices all went to private Catholic schools. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Many political scientists are alarmed by the changes President Trump has made to the U.S. government since he took office.
We're no longer living in a liberal democracy.
The United States is moving in the direction of autocratization.
Into what's called competitive authoritarianism.
Checking in on the state of American democracy on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The body of Pope Francis will lie in state for 3 days at St. Peter's Basilica ahead of his funeral on Saturday. That was announced today by Cardinals meeting at the Vatican a day after Francis died at the age of 88. The Vatican says the Pope suffered a stroke that left him in a coma and he died of heart failure hours after celebrating Easter Sunday. The Pope's funeral will be held in St. Peter's Square. NPR's Sarah Ventry says clergy of all faiths are remembering Francis and reflecting on his legacy.
The Episcopal Church's presiding bishop, Sean Rowe, said of Pope Francis in a statement, "Throughout his life and ministry, he has been a witness for the gospel and a champion for the poor and marginalized." The Presbyterian Church USA posted on Facebook saying, "His life was a testament to humility and compassion, embodying the spirit of service and love for our neighbors." It also said Pope Francis's commitment to social justice and environmental stewardship inspired millions. Francis was particularly vocal on issues related to the environment and migration, and was known to make public addresses to world leaders about policies he saw as unjust. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
People in the U.S. and around the world are marking Earth Day today. It's a tradition that dates back to 1970. This is NPR News. The gunman who killed 23 people and injured dozens more at a Walmart store in Texas has pleaded guilty to capital murder. That attack took place 6 years ago in El Paso. Aaron Montes with member station KTEP reports.
Victims and families filled the courtroom. Some wiped tears while listening to prosecutors recite facts from the day Patrick Crucius drove to El Paso and opened fire on shoppers in the parking lot and inside the store. According to police, the gunman wanted to kill Mexicans and prevent the Hispanic invasion of Texas. District Court Judge Sam Medrano told the gunman he failed in his mission to terrorize the community.
Your name and your hate will be forgotten.
Crucius will serve life in prison and waived his right to seek parole and appeal the case as part of a plea agreement with the El Paso County District Attorney's Office. I'm Aaron Montes in El Paso.
The International Monetary Fund is downgrading its outlook for the U.S. and world economies for this year and next. The IMF cites President Trump's sweeping tariffs and economic uncertainty. The Swiss pharmaceutical company Roche says it expects to create 12,000 jobs in the U.S. over the next 5 years. The company is planning to open new manufacturing facilities and high-tech research centers in several states. Stocks are sharply higher in early trading on Wall Street. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet on Earth Day and every day through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Justice Department has moved on to its next phase of a case to break up Google. If you need some background on this case, we will save you the trouble of Googling it. A judge has already found that Google illegally monopolized its digital advertising technology. And in the past, another ruling said Google had monopolized its search features, too. The company used its power to block competition, according to these rulings. Now the Justice Department and Google are attending a hearing this week to present competing visions for how the company should stop doing all of this. We're joined by Rohit Chopra. President Trump appointed him to one of the Democratic slots on the U.S. Federal Trade Commission once upon a time, years ago. He was also head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau until President Trump fired him early in his second term. So we called him for his perspective. I just want to ask about Google. It's a ubiquitous fact of life. I mean, I use it several times per day without even thinking. And I guess I probably see a lot of Google-placed ads without even thinking that Google was the source. So what does it even mean that they were monopolizing the ad market?
Well, all of us want to make sure that there is a free and fair internet that is open for new competitors. But what the court has found is that Google engaged in a scheme to choke off competition when it comes to online ads. Now, so many local publications, small content creators, they depend on the revenue from ads, and all sorts of businesses spend money to advertise online, and Google took more than its fair share on both sides of that equation.
I know that the technical parts of this can get complicated, but essentially we're thinking about, for example, a local newspaper that might once have sold its own ads, but instead someone is finding their article through Google and they end up seeing a Google ad. Is that it?
That's right. In many cases, websites across the internet include technology that integrates Google's advertising protocols. And that means that Google is the one serving up those ads through those websites, even though it is not a Google property. And Google took control of key ad exchanges. This is where advertisers figure out how much they're going to pay. And all of this amounted to a big conflict of interest that really hurt people across the entire economy.
I want to make sure that I understand the impact to society here. Obviously, there are some people who are doing business who felt they were disadvantaged, but we just talked about local publications like a local newspaper. There is an incredible dearth of local news coverage in this country at this point. Does it seem to you that Google is partly or largely responsible for that, driving a lot of papers out of business or making them much weaker and poorer?
Well, here's what's interesting. It's not that people aren't wanting to read local news, but the economic model has changed. As journalism has shifted online, those digital ads increasingly have money going to Google and Facebook rather than the actual publication and the journalists who are writing that content.
So let's talk through solutions. Do you break up Google? I mean, what are the possible solutions on the table here?
Well, some people believe that Google's control of ad networks and exchanges are a big problem. It's kind of like a big Wall Street bank owning the New York Stock Exchange. It's a fundamental conflict of interest. Hmm. I do think we're going to have to look at spinning off various parts of these conglomerates.
Now, I'm interested in this process because the Justice Department makes its proposal, but Google also gets to make their proposal. What do you do if you're the company that says, actually, we're innocent, we're doing nothing wrong, but they're told anyway, come up with a solution to this problem?
Well, now the judge is going to look at different ways to fix the problem, but we don't want to see Google put forth something that will do nothing to fix the problem, and I certainly hope they will not try and seek a cheap settlement with the government.
Speaking as an official who was appointed by President Trump once upon a time to an important job in his first term, this administration has given an impression of being anti-monopoly and in favor of the little guy. Is that not true?
It's hard to say when you look at the inauguration and the front row is full of big tech conglomerate CEOs. And it was recently reported that Mark Zuckerberg met with the president purportedly to cut some sort of deal to get out of Facebook's own antitrust trial.
Rohit Chopra is a former commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission and also a former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
It's Earth Day and Mother Nature is back with a new mixtape.
Okay, maybe nature didn't exactly do this, but the music honors nature.
Revolutionary subdued.
That's from the second volume of Sounds Right, where artists release songs on Spotify with nature sounds. It's an initiative by the United Nations.
Where they take the streaming income from the songs that we make and put it towards conservation efforts. It's just a morning
prayer. The R&B artist Raveena was excited about using her music in this way. Over the past year, the project has generated more than $200,000. George the Poet is a spoken word artist in London. That's how I think of Layla, spoken word artist. Anyway.
I mean, true. Yeah,
exactly. Anyway, George the Poet was inspired by nature that exists in places where people might not expect it.
There's life everywhere. The sky, the earth, the sea.
We grew up in public housing. They're often imagined to be grey and hard and not have much green. But in our experience, there was just green all around us. There were fields, there were trees. We were always climbing the trees. We were always going on some adventure.
He's been finding the line between creating art as an escape for others and being an activist.
Part of me wants to create escapist music, but I'm always concerned about what happens when the music stops.
Magnus Munster, a Danish artist, got involved with Sounds Right as an outlet for his own anxiety about climate change.
Cause I don't wanna be strong anymore.
I believe in the potential of the project as a part of a bigger personal journey of being as climate positive as I can whilst trying to motivate others to find their way of doing the same.
All the songs and sounds can be found on the Nature artist profile on major music streaming platforms. I never thought about that. Mother Nature has her own artist profile, which is something to sing about. This is NPR News.
Our search for new sources of drinking water continues with a visit to a city that's running out of it, just 30 miles from Lake Michigan. Next time on Here and Now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. For almost a century, Oscar voters have recognized the best movies, and now those voters have to actually watch first. Until now, voters had only been encouraged to do so, except in a few categories like Best Foreign Language Film and Best Documentary Feature. Some voters anonymously confessed they didn't get around to watching some of the biggest and longest movies. Now, there's no more skipping your homework. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldig.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. When he was in the White House the first time, the president rarely said much about local matters here in Washington, D.C. Lately, he's been more vocal, and local leaders have been more careful, knowing the city's financial future could be on the line. Here's Alex Coma from our member station WAMU.
In June 2020, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser ordered that a street leading up to the White House be emblazoned with the words Black Lives Matter in bright yellow font. It was hard to escape the message to the mansion's occupant.
That message is to the American people, that Black lives matter, Black humanity matters, and we as a city raise that up.
Flash forward to last month, Bowser had city workers rip the mural out. The symbolism was once again quite powerful, albeit in a different direction. Trump had long complained about the plaza, and Republicans in Congress had threatened to take action, but hadn't done so yet.
Now our focus is on making sure our residents and our economy survives.
The deconstruction of such a well-known piece of public art may be the most visible example of D.C.'s new posture towards Trump, but it's hardly the only one. After all, Trump has repeatedly threatened to take over the city's government. He has signed an executive order aimed at combating crime and homelessness in the city, and he's even contemplated exercising his powers to temporarily seize control of local police. Here's Trump on Air Force One in February.
I like the mayor. I get along great with the mayor. But they're not doing the job. Too much crime. Too much graffiti.
The city already has very limited self-governance, known as home rule. So when the White House does things like complain about a specific tent encampment near the State Department's offices, as it did in March, city officials rush to clear it out. It's an approach that has rankled some in the heavily Democratic city. But lawmakers like D.C. Councilmember Zachary Parker are willing to forgive some cooperation with the administration by the mayor if it protects the city's autonomy.
I know they appreciate that the district itself is in a very precarious situation. With congressional interference and the threat of all types of impacts to home rule.
Still, a dispute last month at the U.S. Institute of Peace points to the tensions within the city. Elon Musk's team from the Department of Government Efficiency was trying to gain access to the Institute's headquarters after firing the nonprofit's leadership. But when staff wouldn't let them inside, federal prosecutors called D.C. police to the scene. After some back and forth, officers escorted Musk's team into the building. There's still legal action playing out about whether the White House was allowed to do this, but some lawmakers, like D.C. Councilmember Janice Lewis George, question whether local cops should have agreed to help.
There is this whole theme of let's be preemptively complicit. I just don't think that is the right strategy for us moving forward.
Hanging over any interaction between the feds and the locals is the city's looming budget crisis. Congress has barred the city from spending roughly $1.1 billion of its own money as part of an obscure provision of a government funding bill. The Senate passed legislation to reverse that change, but the House of Representatives still has not done so, despite intense lobbying from D.C. leaders. Bowser has ordered cuts while debate in the House drags on, but Ankit Jain, who advocates for D.C. statehood as a shadow senator, observes that the city's position is made that much more difficult by being forced to rely on the federal government for something as simple as spending its own money.
The only reason we're in this situation is because D.C. is not a state.
Trump has said he wants the funding deal to get done. If it doesn't, then city leaders may choose to reevaluate their approach. For NPR News in Washington, D.C., I'm Alex Coma.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
It is a bipartisan complaint. Unfairly cheap parts for solar panels made overseas. The import tax can now be a hefty one.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Gamma. Gamma uses AI to generate presentations, websites, social media, and documents from a single prompt. More at gamma.app.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. A 3,500% tariff is an import duty 35 times higher than the item itself. That is the high end of tariffs announced on key components for solar panels imported from Southeast Asian countries. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
The Commerce Department announced new tariffs after a year-long illegal dumping investigation dating back to the Biden administration. If finalized, they'd be imposed on solar cells, usually a few inches in size, which are assembled into panels, and those are the things that go on the roofs of people's homes, for example. American manufacturers filed a complaint that China was circumventing previous tariffs by producing cells in Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia, and then importing them into the U.S. below cost. It is this kind of circumvention of trade restrictions that the Trump administration has cited as a reason we need global tariffs. But with the new import duties, American solar panel manufacturers could face higher prices for cells, making their panels more expensive. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
The International Monetary Fund says the trade war means the world is shifting into slower economic growth. It's predicting U.S. economic growth this year of 1.8%, down from 2.7% forecast in January. We do have a partial turnaround for stock indexes. After the Dow fell more than 970 points yesterday, the index is up 786 points or 2.1%. Now the S&P is up 1.9%. The NASDAQ is up 2.2%. NADA DHL, the package delivery service that says it is overburdened by new U.S. rules at the border. The Germany-based firm has stopped delivering boxes to U.S. consumers if what's in the box is worth more than $800. Business customers will still get their shipments. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
The expanded customs requirements DHL says it's dealing with mean a lot more paperwork and documentation, according to Bloomberg analyst Lee Klaskow. And that, he says, slows things down. He compares it to more people having to go through the slow lane at airport security.
You got to take your shoes off. You got to take your liquids out. That's kind of what's happening now. There's just more scrutiny.
Klaskow says that extra scrutiny has come along with the new tariffs, and it's overwhelmed DHL, which is why it's imposing the temporary suspension. Klaskow says it's possible some shipments will be delayed, though he doesn't expect anything major. And he says this is an example of how complicated it is to work in global shipping right now.
Because it's just showing you how much supply chains are having to change, and it's sometimes not very easy to react on a dime.
It's possible we'll see other logistics companies make similar moves, says Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State.
The more uncertainty there is, the more value there is in hitting the pause button. And so it seems very likely there'll be a lot of pause buttons being hit.
He says the U.S. spent decades simplifying global trade, but now it's getting more complicated. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
The Department of Health and Human Services has stopped the flow of money designated by Congress to protect immigrant children from exploitation. Layoffs have hit legal aid groups across the country that help the tens of thousands of kids who cross the U.S.-Mexico border by themselves, young people especially vulnerable to, for instance, forced labor once inside the U.S. Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval has that.
19-year-old Sophia has a soft spot for animals. She pulls out her phone to show me a tiny kitten she rescued at the beach near Galveston.
Cuando lo rescaté, estaba así.
She found him so young, his eyes were still closed.
Todavía no había abierto los ojos.
The beach is one of Sophia's favorite places since she moved to the U.S. 5 years ago. She traveled here alone with her younger brother. At the time, she was eager to attend high school, but her guardian in Houston, a family member, told her she had to work instead.
So él dijo, tú no vas a estudiar, tú vas a trabajar.
Sophia says all her wages went to her guardian to pay rent. We're not using her real name because of her open immigration case. Sophia worked long hours at fast food jobs where she'd break down and cry because she wanted to be studying.
Yo lloraba noche y día, lloraba.
But Sophia had a secret weapon, her legal team. She had been connected to them through a federally funded program for unaccompanied minors. When she told them she was being forced to work, they said, "You have the right to go to school." And with the legal team's help, Sophia got to finish high school. Today, she's got her own apartment, a retail job, and she says one day she'd like to be a vet or a teacher. Now, the program that helped protect Sophia is ending. The funding supported 26,000 unaccompanied minors with their immigration cases. For now, the Galveston Houston Immigrant Representation Project will stick with Sophia's case because of other funding streams. But they are cutting staff. Alexis Sandukas heads up the Immigrant Children Program.
This loss of funding was almost 50% of our organizational budget, and it's almost half of our staff.
While she says it's hard to see attorneys lose their jobs,
they're mostly concerned for the children.
Her group represents some 300 clients who came to the U.S. as children without a parent or sponsor.
We don't intend to withdraw from our cases, but other organizations are. And we're also thinking of all the hundreds of thousands of other children that are not going to receive legal services because of this termination of funding.
Without legal advocates, University of Arizona's Shefali Melcharek-Desai worries that already at-risk kids are even more exposed to trafficking and exploitation.
I haven't seen any evidence that the insatiable demand that America has for low-wage labor has disappeared.
She says industries will keep seeking cheap child labor. So with this funding going away,
exploitation will continue and be worse, because there won't be anyone providing legal information and assistance to these children.
Legal groups have sued to bring back this congressionally approved funding. For now, a bare-bones legal orientation program remains, and only for a short time. HHS didn't respond to a request for comment on this story. I'm Elizabeth Trovall from Marketplace.
Elizabeth has long experience covering border issues for us and other public media. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.